from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Even the most politically engaged voter gets down to the bottom of the ballot and draws a blank at the judicial candidates. Unless you work in the law or live with somebody who does, your chances of knowing who's running for a judge's seat are slim to none. And good luck looking for news coverage. Few newsrooms have the resources to focus on these races with everything else going on in California politics. But don't you, the voter, want some say over who sits on the bench? We'll talk to one law professor who argues against electing judges altogether, and naturally, one who argues for it. That's coming up on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, and today for Michael Krasny. If you're like me, you're planning to vote in the upcoming primary. In fact, you probably vote in most every election, even if the only choice on the ballot is pastrami versus roast beef. But if you're like me, you have to research first, read the news, listen to interviews on Forum, maybe even attend a debate. That's not often an option when the race is for a judge's seat. Some of our judges in California are appointed, and some say that's the way to go for all the seats on the bench. Joining us to debate this question today is Jessica Levinson, professor and associate professor teaching election law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. You also wrote an op-ed for the LA Times recently, which is why we're talking about this today. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on to talk about this.
And we've also got Associate Law Professor Scott Gaylord of Elon University Law School. Thank you so much for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, Professor Levinson, why don't we start with you? Going back to that op-ed in the LA Times, If I don't know anything about candidates for judgeships, is it the more responsible thing to do to simply not vote?
Well, it might be, because what happens is we just don't have a lot of information at all. I mean, it's hard for me to describe every election cycle, the number of people who say, can you give me your thoughts on who to vote for? I really have no idea who these people are. And in part, why don't we have an idea? Well, we just don't get a lot of information about them, as you said. People have to undertake a lot of research, which they typically don't do. And so what we're left with is basically the name on the ballot and these three words in the case of California. And a lot of times those three words are some combination of criminal, gang, prosecutor, homicide, or prosecution, because those things tend to play well with the public. And I just don't think this is the best way to decide who makes, you know, the very important legal decisions that people are faced with every day. State courts make 95% of decisions, and I think there is a much better way to do it, and I don't think that an electorate that is this ill-informed should be weighing in.
Professor Gaylord, I presume voters in North Carolina are better informed?
Varies probably from election to election and locale to locale. We have elections in North Carolina as well, going to your question. I think what's sometimes called voter roll-off, as you go farther down the ballot, fewer and fewer people vote, indicates that some people self-select and don't vote if they don't feel like they have good information or enough information. Some people certainly may. And then go ahead and, if you will, hazard a guess. And I would agree with Professor Levinson that more information is a good thing, an important thing, and we should encourage that with people. It can be difficult to get, but I think elections can still serve an important role with respect to legitimacy and accountability of the judiciary. I think, as Winston Churchill famously stated, democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the rest. I think the same may hold true for judicial elections as well. There's no perfect system, but you want to think about what are the criteria that we want out of our judiciary. Not simply do we like or dislike a particular opinion, but what is it that we want from our judges and the judiciary as a whole, and that which selection method best accounts for the majority of those factors.
It would be nice to think that voters were choosing which judge to elect based on, you know, a history of legal decisions. But my guess is for a lot of people, they're voting because they like the name. You know, like they don't really have a strong sense of who it is they're voting for.
I'm not sure. I can start that. Then Professor Levinson can jump in. I mean, at some case, that's going to be true. And as I mentioned, the farther you go down the ballot, then the less campaigning that's probably been done, less advertising, less concern major media outlets have in editorials or in endorsements through the paper. So it can be harder to get information. I do think, and part of it depends on one's view of the judiciary. You know, the more you view judges as political, then I think the more that elections can make sense as a check on that political process. You know, judges do a lot of important work, as Professor Levinson mentioned, about 95% of cases go through that, but that impacts people directly in their lives. And I think we know from the appointment process at the federal level that it's a highly political process, whether a current justice is going to retire and whether President Obama gets to make that selection or the next president is a very important issue. And for some folks, you know, you can hear them start talking about being dispositive as to whom they'll vote for in the next election. And so the political nature of the judiciary is an important part. That's not a criticism. They're not politicians. But their views on things like statutory construction, federalism, separation of powers, judicial restraint, and a variety of other factors vary from conservatives to liberals to libertarians and others, and that type of thing really influences the decisions that they might make in given cases.
Professor Levinson, can you get us up to speed with what the system looks like in California? It's actually kind of a hybrid, isn't it? Some judges are elected, but others are appointed.
I would. It's somewhere in between, I guess, pastrami and roast beef, if we're going to go with this analogy. So first, if I could respond briefly to Professor Gaylord, I mean, I think we both agree there is no perfect system, and he points out that the appointment process is not free of politics. I mean, anytime you get three people in the room, nothing is going to be free of politics. So, and he also points out, you know, really no system is perfect. So what do I want? I mean, I actually prefer the system where we do appoint, where we don't think of judges as politicians, where we try and get close to a merit-based selection, where it's not quite perfect and there will always be problems, but it will treat judges more like professionals. And we talked about a little bit of what are the things we care about with respect to judges. I want them not at all to care about whether their opinions are popular. I want them to care about whether their opinions are right, and I want them to be independent. And I think this leads into your question about what do we do in California? As you said, it's the pastrami roast beef test in California. So what we do is on the Supreme Court level, the governor can appoint justices. And the Commission on Judicial Appointments has to confirm those appointments. And then later, these justices will stand for retention elections, which are not competitive elections. It basically is just an up or down vote. Does this person get to keep their job or not? And this is also what happens on the appellate level. Then on the state court, on the trial court level, a lot of times the governor will appoint, but it's only to fill a vacancy. So there are also open seat elections as well. And then, as opposed to standing for retention elections, trial court judges will stand for competitive elections. Now, oftentimes, it's the culture, particularly in Los Angeles, that sitting judges are not challenged. It's very much frowned upon, but there's always the possibility that that could happen. So I think it always looms large, the possibility that a judge could face a challenger because they feel they've made a decision that is either unpopular or upsets someone. And again, I don't want those thoughts in the back of a judge's mind. I want what are the facts and what are the law.
But going back to the governor, who hands the governor a list of suggested names?
So the governor gets a non-binding report from the State Bar's Commission on Judicial Nominees Evaluation, or as we call it, the Jenny Commission. And the governor will then appoint, and as I said, then there's another check. There's the Judicial Council on Appointments, and that's made up of the Attorney General, the Chief Justice, and the Senior Presiding Justice of the Court of Appeals. So there are a number of people other than just the governor who weigh in on this decision.
Professor Gaylord, what do you think about this system?
I think there's some attractive features of the California system, as Professor Levinson mentions. Independence is certainly an important feature here. I think it's easy to forget, though, it's important to have independence from the other branches of government as well, that separation of powers are important. And if you have a judiciary that's beholden to particular institutions, one of the things, the primary check on the executive and legislative branches comes through the judiciary. And if the judiciary has to look for its job to the executive and legislative branch, then you have that same problem coming back. Are they going to be skewing decisions? Now, at one level, I think we have to rely on the integrity of the judiciary for elections or from this type of appointment model. I think one of the features I like about the California model that Professor Levinson advocates is that it does provide for some accountability and allows the electorate to have a say. In that sense, if you don't like the judges that were being appointed, you can take action through the electing of the governor or possibly attorney general and, influence members who are directly involved in that selection process. So I think that provides a check that is very important so that the judiciary is bound as well in our system.
Professor Gaylord, we've all watched Law and Order. We've seen, at least on a fictional court setting, judges making tiny decisions that sway a case or kill it. They have biases. They have personal preferences. Has there ever been a case where a judge was tossed out because the population was upset about a judge's behavior or a ruling in a case?
There certainly can be situations where that happens. Now, generally, the statistics show overwhelmingly that if you have something like retention elections, which are currently in place for some of the judges in California, they were reelected at, I think, the last study from it was something like a 98.2% retention rate. So it's almost a de facto lifetime appointment in those situations. But there are cases where that happens. I think probably most recently or most famously is when the Iowa Supreme Court interpreted its constitution in certain ways to extend equal protection under due process rights to same-sex individuals, then couples, then the following elections. I think three of the four justices who voted that were voted out. There was a strong reaction with respect to that. So controversial topics, it certainly can play a role. And the judges, in some sense, may, if you will, have to worry about it. Now, whether or not, I don't think there's any empirical evidence showing that judges have actually swayed their votes. I mean, in a particular case at a certain judge, there may be. And then that's why I think judicial elections, one reason they can be useful is because then you're in a situation where if a judge does pander to special interests or other things and disregards the law as interpreted by a majority, then they can vote that individual out.
But or disregards popular opinion. Which gets back to Professor Levinson's point that sometimes you don't want a judge worried about popular opinion so much as trying to make a decision based on the law and precedent.
Sure, that's certainly an important feature. But in terms of that, and the precedent is one thing when it's established, but as to what exactly is required by the law, that is not frequently it's not written in stone. I think the recent decision by the United States Supreme Court, Town of Greece versus Galloway, which dealt with legislative prayer, is sort of a good example of that. You've got a very fractured court. You've got a 5-4 decision at one level, but only three justices join the part talking about coercion. Justice Alito writes a concurrence. Justice Thomas writes part of a concurrence that he's alone in. Scalia joins in another. Breyer writes a separate dissent. And then Kagan writes a dissent for four justices. What does the Establishment Clause require? It's not altogether clear. It's not self-defining in terms of that term. And if you have elections then in terms of state law and the state justices, make common law, they interpret the Constitution and establish constitutional law and principles, to have a check as to what those terms mean by itself may not be a bad thing. In fact, the empirical research shows it increases the legitimacy of the court.
Well, that's an interesting question, the legitimacy of the court and the appearance of either credibility or lack of credibility. Professor Levinson, you've looked a lot into campaign finance questions. Who contributes to campaigns for judicial elections?
Sure.
Lawyers?
Well, it is. I mean, who contributes? It tends to be people who know the judges or the judge knows. And, a lot of this is human nature. Contributions, why do you give a contribution? Because you want someone to win. And why do you want them to win? It could either be you will support my position or we're ideologically aligned. And none of this is necessarily nefarious. I mean, this is the system that we live in. But the problem when it comes to judges is that, it's not just Are they potentially changing their vote because they got money from a contributor? And there is actually some statistical evidence to indicate that at least in state Supreme Courts, where there's been a lot of heavy spending, there is evidence to indicate that at some points these justices are voting against prior decisions or against their previous position. I mean, as Professor Gaylord says, you know, all you need to do is look at the Supreme Court to say, oftentimes we overturn precedent. But there was an interesting 2008 study out of Louisiana that showed it looks like donations can actually change behavior. But then if you look separate from, are we changing behavior once someone's on the bench, I think the next question is, well, who's getting elected in the first place? And this is a question that we look at when we're talking about politicians, too. But I think, you know, arguably it's even more important with respect to the judiciary. And, you know, special interests, and I don't use that word to have a negative connotation, can play a role in who actually gets to sit on the bench. So who is it? It's lawyers, it's lobbyists. Increasingly, it's corporate interests, it's business interests. The Chamber of Commerce plays a pretty large role in a number of races throughout the country. So, you know, it's, again, it's the make of the court, and then it's what the judges end up deciding once they're on the bench. And you asked, to go back, you asked for an example of, you know, are judges ever thrown out? And Professor Gaylord had a great example. You know, another one for maybe some older listeners in California, Rose Byrd, Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, thrown out because of her opposition to the death penalty, a very, you know, continues to be a hot-button political issue. So it's not often, but for, in my opinion, the possibility alone is enough to say, you know, I don't want that to weigh into a judge's calculus. What is going to happen to me in the next election? Who am I going to have to ask for money? I don't think those questions are appropriate when it comes to members of the judiciary.
Professor Gaylord, the examples we're talking about are at a pretty high level, the state Supreme Court level, you know, big hot topic issues, hot button issues. But on the really local level, Superior Court, I have to imagine that lawyers are contributing to judges' campaigns. And, you know, if I'm sitting on the bench and somebody comes, two lawyers come in front of me and one of them gave a lot of money in the last campaign, at the very least, there's the appearance of a conflict of interest.
There's certainly, I mean, from some perspective can be an appearance of that. I mean, there's certainly a sense as to who gave, and with disclosure requirements, we can know those things. I think the more you have rigorous disclosure requirements, the better. As a result, then people can know that. The judge will know that people know that and will make it much harder for him or her to just have, you know, blatant bias in one direction or another. And that's true. We all carry the baggage that we carry to our professions and our jobs. And so even if you had an appointment system, now the one that is in California probably helps to minimize that. Other states have what are called the Missouri plans, where you have nominating commissions, unelected folks, a large number of those made up of attorneys. It's going to be much harder to police the type of bias that could come in through political appointments as well. And so I think there's, again, this is the problem with a no-perfect system, that there can be bias in the picture regardless, and then which system gives you the most transparency and ability to monitor and to change and reflect that, and I think judicial elections provide for that. It is a concern, and it certainly can be problematic, you know, most famously in the Caperton case out of West Virginia, where the court found the Supreme Court found a due process violation. But I think in those circumstances, as the court suggests, are going to be rare and then can be monitored through disclosure and other types of requirements where people can keep track of the spending and then look more carefully to see if there's a reason for recusal. And if a judge doesn't do that, then bring actions on the due process clause to force him or her to do that.
Professor Levinson, we don't seem to hear, at least in the news headlines, about a lot of judges who've gone rogue or, you know, or making egregious decisions that call, you know, attention to them over this issue. Could it be that the system we've got is doing okay?
Well, yes. Is it doing okay? Well, I mean, I don't think that we're floundering. I mean, but just because a system may be passable doesn't mean that we shouldn't try and improve upon it. But to the extent that we're not hearing, I will say that's actually part of the reason I think there shouldn't be elections, is because a lot of these decisions are not made really in the light of day, other than when there's a particularly controversial opinion that might be politically useful for an opponent. And that tends to be when we hear about decisions. So to me, that the fact that we're, you know, this isn't always splashed across the front page of a newspaper doesn't necessarily indicate that it's working well. I would agree with Professor Gaylord absolutely about the need for disclosure. Unfortunately, that's not the world that we live in. It is with respect to direct contributions to judges, but Professor Gaylord mentioned the Caperton case, and Caperton was actually about, as he knows, independent expenditures, that there was a litigant who made an independent expenditure funneled through another group of about $3 million to oppose one state Supreme Court candidate and help another, who ended up weighing in on a decision about this spender. And unfortunately, it was actually kind of difficult to figure out who was behind that independent expenditure, as is something that's happening in political campaigns across the country, where there's so much so-called dark money flowing through the system. And so, you know, when Americans for Apple Pie or West Virginians for Smiles and Bunnies spends money, it's not always immediately clear to the voters, who frankly aren't paying a lot of attention already, who is spending.
So, and I guess it's worth noting, too, that unlike in previous worlds or previous years when maybe these elections didn't merit a lot of outside spending, now we are seeing more outside spending. It's the world we live in now.
Well, I think that's right. And again, you know, if you just think about it from kind of a rational, almost business perspective, people are spending money because they think it can make a difference. And that doesn't mean that people who are spending money are wrongdoers. It means that they're functioning within a system that I don't think is appropriate. And if you're spending money because you think it can make a difference on the makeup of the judiciary or on what the judges are deciding, then I really think we have to look, not only is there an actual problem, which I think there is, but how does this look to people? I mean, you know, a number of recent studies coming out of Princeton, coming out of the Ohio Supreme Court, there was a New York Times report on this, indicate that people actually think that it is, you know, somewhere between a problem and a big problem that money does play a role in judicial elections. And even if it's just appearances, that's a problem when it is when we're talking about the legislative branch, but particularly when we're talking about judges. We have to have faith that when we go into court, we are getting a fair shake.
We're talking about the idea of dumping elections for judgeships in California. What do you think? Do you want to say over who sits on the bench, or would you rather the decisions were left to people in the legal profession and our elected representatives? Call us and join the conversation at 866-733-6786. And now that you've got your pen at the ready, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments and questions there. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This hour, we're talking about electing judges in California. Should we be doing it or not? We're talking with Professors Jessica Levinson, Associate Professor teaching election law at Loyola Law School. She's also the Vice President of the Los Angeles City Ethics Commission, and Associate Professor of Law Scott Gaylord of Elon University School of Law. He frequently writes on issues relating to elections. We're asking for your comments, questions, concerns. You can call us at 866-733-6786. Why don't we start now with Chris in Oakland?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, Chris. If you turn down your radio, it'll be a little easier to hear what you're saying.
I was in the process of doing that, but you got to me too fast.
Okay.
The idea of credibility is long gone. I used to serve on my county fee arbitration commission, and we had cases where when we reviewed the file and the original correspondence between the client and the lawyer, the only information the client wanted in choosing their lawyer was a list of contributions that the firm had made to local judges. That's the only basis on which they chose their attorneys. And this was 25 years ago.
Oh, boy.
You know, and you got to follow the money. It was not Rose Byrd who was thrown out. It was Rose Byrd, Cruz Reynoso, and my labor law professor, Joe Groden. And the money came from the insurance industry. The furor came about the death penalty, but it was entirely funded by the insurance industry.
So, Chris, let me ask you, what do you think is better, electing judges, appointing judges, or do you figure that there's really nothing that selection process can fix, that it's already too corrupt?
What has to happen is throughout the entire system, we have to have publicly funded elections. We whether it's the governor who's doing the appointment or the judges that he or she is appointing, we have to get money out of politics.
Professor Levinson, is this something that is feasible? Can we do this?
Well, there are some states that have public financing of judicial elections. Public financing can help in terms of getting candidates who wouldn't normally be able to raise a lot of money, get their voices out to the voters. The problem is it doesn't eliminate independent expenditures. Independent expenditures have been and will remain for the foreseeable future unlimited. So what you have are the candidates, or at least one candidate, who is getting taxpayer dollars to run. But what you have on the other hand is absolutely no handcuffs on the outside spending that in that case can actually start playing a much more crucial role in the race. And we saw, for instance, in the Caperton decision that we were talking about earlier, the independent expenditures actually eclipsed the spending by the judicial candidates. So, you know, unfortunately, I would love to live in a world where this is possible. It really is not possible to have elections where we reduce the influence of money over these elections. And so public financing can be an incremental improvement in some cases, I think, but it doesn't get us across the finish line.
Chris, thank you so much for your question. Beth writes, appointed by officials, one need only look at the Supreme Court of the United States to see how well that works. I prefer citizens elect their judges and that we have judges that look at the bigger picture while being constitutionally minded. Another listener writes, citizens know very little about the people who are up for election. I think we need to appoint, but the nominees should be chosen and appointed by a panel of their peers, and politicians should be kept at arm's length. Otherwise, the judiciary becomes purely political. The Supreme Court, and I believe she's referring to the U.S. Supreme Court, is full of political creatures. Professor Gaylord, it does seem as if people don't have the greatest regard for the U.S. Supreme Court, perhaps as a result of the appointment process.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a difficult thing for any judge or justice, right? United States Supreme Court justice famously said something to the effect of, you know, in general, we think that decisions we like are constitutional and decisions we don't like are unconstitutional. So
that seems fair, yes.
You know, without really studying or having the opportunity, understandably, because it's hard to do, to look at what the Constitution says, what the past precedents have been, and a variety of other factors. That's why we have the judges, to be able to do that. And to provide a separate and hopefully independent and qualified review of these types of decisions. Certainly the United States Supreme Court, because it takes controversial cases and they have the benefit of being an Article III judge or justice, they have the benefit of lifetime appointments. But again, some people find that unappealing. They're not alone. Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln were concerned about what they call the quote-unquote despotism of an oligarchy, end quote, that you have now nine justices who are the last arbiter of all things constitutional. And there was great concern among these great leaders of our nation that they would have so much authority and be able to just decide things and then not have any type of check on them. And so certainly elections are one way to do that. The California system, Professor Levinson advocates, is another one where voters can still play a role. But there is something, I think, for a lot of folks, and it varies from across the country. 22 states have judicial elections. 5 have some type of democratic appointment, like California. 13 have this, what I mentioned, is the Missouri plan. And then there's other 10 other states with hybrids. It varies. And as Justice Brandeis said, states can be laboratories of experiment, trying to figure out what works best for them amid all these sort of imperfect systems. What can we find that will provide the greatest? Again, you got to fill in the blank. What are you looking for? Independence, accountability, qualifications of judges and justices. Are there any other factors? Think about those. And I think that's lost in the larger picture sometimes. What exactly do we want? Not just judges who rule the way we do. If so, fine. Then you try to find those and vote for them. But presumably there's something more that we're looking for out of the judiciary, and then which system can effectuate that for us.
If you had a magic wand, Professor Levinson, what would you want to see in California?
Well, what I would want to see in California is something along the lines that I advocated in my op-ed, which is I don't actually love our hybrid, you know, pastrami roast beef system. I want to go straight for the lox. I mean, what I want is I don't want to see judges on ballots. And, you know, I for all the reasons that I've discussed. And
so
I
then
know
that sounds like you don't want a hybrid at all. What you want are an appointment panel of some kind.
That's exactly right. So, you know, what I advocated for was essentially the appointment situation that we have now, which is already built in. We already have the infrastructure for that. But we take out the second step, which is the retention elections. So I said, look at what we're already doing on the appellate level, and, you know, let's let the governor decide and let him do that while he's discussing it with the Jenny Commission, while there's another commission that's made up of the AG and the Chief Justice and the Senior Justice of the Court of Appeals, and they have to confirm that person. But I don't then want that person to be on the ballot years later. And I know there's been a lot of discussion of the Supreme Court as kind of everyone's favorite punching bag, and you know, I absolutely agree with Professor Gaylord that it can't be that good opinions are just the ones we agree with. And therefore, to me, that's another indication that we shouldn't be weighing in. Because a good opinion, you know, it might not be something that's popular. And I will say, I think there's a lot of focus on the Supreme Court. And, you know, that makes a lot of sense. They're the most visible court, but kind of two responses to that. One is there are hundreds of lower-level federal judges who are applying the law of the Supreme Court and are doing so, I think, very well, with very high-quality opinions that are very effective. Why is the Supreme Court also everyone's favorite punching bag? I think it's not just that it's controversial, it's that a lot of these issues are matters of first impression. So it's not always clear that they're directly overturning precedent. What is clear oftentimes to at least half of us is that we don't necessarily agree. And then, you know, last point is, that's right, there is no check on the Supreme Court. But then so then we add another check. And who checks that check? So I am leery of adding layer upon layer to this process.
Let's return to the phones. John in San Francisco.
Good morning. My question has to do with learning more about the judges and the decisions that they make. Computers have made it very easy in our court system to look up cases in which plaintiffs and defendants have been involved. But you can't do that with judges. And I'd like to ask your guests to weigh in on this and whether or not they think it would be helpful, as I do, to be able to punch in the name of the judge in the computer and get the judge's decisions.
What an excellent idea. Professors, do either of you want to address that? Has anybody done that yet?
I don't know of any state off the top of my head that has that type of fully animated system where you can just type a judge's name and get a list of all the opinions. I think various states are trying ways to get more information out to voters. So North Carolina has a bar survey of all the judges now that attorneys who have practiced before that judge can fill out information. Again, it has its limitations, but at least it's further information, and they can rate that judge based on a variety of different criteria, and then that is distributed by the state bar and available to people generally to get that information. But I don't know of a repository that you can just type in the judge's name. I don't, Professor Levinson, have you heard anything about that?
Well, you know, of course, what we have are legal databases that are not accessible to everyone because they're prohibitively expensive, like Lexis and Westlaw, where you can search for cases and you can search by judge. Oftentimes what you'll find in that case just is published opinions. So you're not getting the full array of everything that every judge has ever said. You know, our, particularly in California, and this is probably a topic for another day, we are so strapped for cash in the court system. And that isn't an argument against making it. I think it's just an argument that I'm not sure we're going to see this type of disclosure soon, which I think would be very beneficial. Regardless of whether we have elections, I think the more information that the public has, the better. I think, you know, judges are public officials, and we should throw the doors open. And this is why I think we should televise more court proceedings, and this is why I think it would be wonderful for members of the public to have access to more judicial opinions.
Professor Levinson, let's talk about self-policing by judges. Many states don't require a judge to recuse herself from a case involving, a party that spent heavily in a recent election. Does California?
Yeah, so there are ethical standards for recusal in California, and I will say, and there are, you know, every state has different kind of judicial canons and when you might be required to recuse themselves. And, you know, a small plug for listeners who are interested, there's a organization called Justice at Stake that actually lays out kind of from A to Z your state and what the rules are for these issues of conflicts of interest and recusal. And I'll say, you know, in addition to state rules, what do we have now? We have the Caperton decision that we've addressed a number of times, which says that due process concerns will dictate that when circumstances are so egregious, such as a $3 million independent expenditure, then that may also dictate recusal. So we have both rules and statutes, and then we also have some Supreme Court decisions.
Let's turn now to Wynn in Menlo Park.
Yes, I'm concerned about two things. Obviously, the money part. I seem to recall a case in West Virginia where there was a mine owner who was losing his case at the lower levels and could see it was going to end up at the West Virginia Supreme Court, who got one of his cronies elected who voted to throw out his case, which I think subsequently was thrown out by the Supreme Court. But is the element of beauty contest. I think of myself as an informed electorate. But frankly, when it comes down to judges, I don't have the opportunity to really understand whether I'm getting a legal opinion of somebody or I'm getting a judge who has never had any legal background. For example, Earl Warren, even though I thought some of the things he did was good, I think he was not well-versed in the law, and we should have judges who are well-versed in the law.
Professor Gaylord, any thoughts on that?
Well, I guess there's a couple different points. One, it is hard to tell in terms of the expenditures. So the Caperton decision is out there. It's not clear how it will be applied, but it is available for folks who think there may be some type of, as the court calls it, quote-unquote, probability of bias. But it's hard to know whether or not, you know, in that situation, whether the owner of the coal business, Massey Coal, was really buying a judge. I think the West Virginia Court of Appeals released some statistics after this came out because I think they were tired of people saying that their judges or justices have been bought off. But Justice Benjamin, who was the judge involved in that case and who allegedly benefited from the money, voted against Massey Energy or its subsidiaries 81.6% of the time, to the tune of about $317 million. In contrast, Massey had benefited from Benjamin's votes only 18.4% of the time for a total of $53 million. So it's hard to say that it was buying off. I think this gets back to something we'd mentioned before about not these terms, but causation versus correlation. That is someone trying to buy somebody off and actually get the vote, or is it just that this is my best chance and I know what the incumbent was like in that? And in fact, in the West Virginia case, the major newspapers had come out against the incumbent after Benjamin was forced to recuse himself. Another panel heard the decision and reached the same outcome. So it's not clear. Now, that gets to the appearance of possible bias, and that's certainly a concern and something that needs to be watched out for. But it's not always is clear whether or not these types of contributions have a direct impact or how widely that decision will be used going forward.
Is it possible, Professor Gaylord, that an industry or a company might have a more sophisticated view of the situation and decide, you know what, we're not going to expect this judge to vote for us every time. And in fact, it would be better if he didn't. We'll call in that chit when we really need it.
I mean, certainly, I guess there's the possibility. Now, it depends what you mean by call that chip in and how you go about doing that in terms of direct communications and telling the judge you have to do this for us now, and whether the judge would acquiesce or not. I think that it's hard, again, to tell with respect to causation versus a correlation. Does the judge vote a certain way because that judge is, quote-unquote, liberal or conservative or libertarian? I mean, is there a consistent voting pattern? And this is why they receive the support of certain entities, companies, or otherwise. As we mentioned, there are differences between judges, and a lot of those have to do with political ideology. Not the only differences, certainly, but those are major considerations as you go forward. And, you know, between elected and appointed judges, a study out of the University of Chicago Law School in 2008 did sort of a comprehensive review of state courts and found that effectively there was no difference between and among elected and appointed judges with respect to their qualifications and their independence as measured by the study. And obviously that's important to look at and see how they did that. But that there's really no difference in terms of the independence of these judges and no direct empirical evidence. Now, there are some studies out there suggesting in certain instances it may have some impact. This overarching study indicated they didn't see it across the board.
Wynn, thank you so much for your thoughts. Chris is an active member of Latino Bar Associations, and he writes in to raise a big issue, the question of the underrepresentation of minorities on the bench in California as well as nationwide. But he points out, for example, Latinos make up 40% of California's population, but only 7% of the judges and 4% of the lawyers. The election process, Chris writes, while historically having excluded minorities in recent times, has created a new avenue, in particular for Latinos and Asians to run in large countries like L.A., San Francisco, Silicon Valley, as evidenced, he says, by the percentage of Latino judges doubling in the last 15 years. Professor Levinson?
Well, you know, actually, I think that cuts both ways. I mean, I think the point is very important. The lack of diversity on the bench is real, and I think it's problematic. But in terms of are elections the best way to get more diversity, I would say no, they're not actually. And what we're seeing, and I think we talked about this in the beginning, is when you really have a lack of information about the candidates, what you tend to look for is, you know, what do you see on the ballot? You see name, you see gender, and then you see three words describing that person's job. And unfortunately, there are a few instances, you know, a few high-profile instances of incumbent judges being ranked as well-qualified and being defeated by challengers who have foreign-sounding last names, essentially, when they're running against incumbent judges with Anglo-Saxon-sounding names. So I think it is absolutely a real problem. My hope is that this would be remedied in part through the appointment process. I was just looking at the, you know, Governor Brown's appointment page, and he is very heavily touting a number of appointments he has made that have increased diversity on the bench. And I think that is something that weighs in the mind, you know, not only of the president, but of also governors across the nation.
It is worth pointing out, I should mention, Chris, like if you get the emails from the governor's office, and this is true for Brown and true for Schwarzenegger before him, like gradually you start to see more diverse names popping up in those appointment emails. But it's also systemic. It's what's coming up. Who are the lawyers coming up, either from DA's offices or public defender's offices or corporate offices? It's a structural thing as well as an appointment issue.
I think that's right. I mean, the number the statistic that jumped out at me, if those statistics are correct, and I don't know enough directly about California, but if 40% of the population in that area is Latino and only 4% of the attorneys are, I think there's a starting point in terms of trying to help grease and diversity and setting up situations in which we can work to increase the representation of different groups in the attorney population. And you don't always have to be an attorney to be a judge, obviously, but I think a lot of people view that as one important consideration. And thereby increasing that, you can then increase the opportunities to affect the diversity of the judiciary as well.
It's also, I suppose, an issue of pay and workload and all of those good things. A very good issue to bring up, Chris. You're listening to Forum, and we are talking to Professor Jessica Levinson of Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and Professor Scott Gaylord of Elon University School of Law. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Rachel Miro. So let's raise now this question from David, who writes, until recently in Alameda County, anyone could look up judges' decisions to see how they rule. Now you have to pay to look at each item in a file, and you cannot freely peruse judges' decisions. Once again, only wealthy litigants have good access. Professor Levinson, you hinted earlier at this question of the underfunding of courts. I think I read recently that there was one Superior Court that actually held a garage sale to raise money. But this is a big issue. If you have to pay to find information, basic information about the legal record in our state, you've got a problem.
This is a huge issue, but unfortunately we're in triage mode and it's not the number one priority on the minds of a lot of people. The number one priority is, you know, you're getting a divorce, you want custody of your child, your neighbor is setting your lawn on fire, you have a domestic violence issue, you have a land use issue, you have to be able to get to court and get redress quickly. And unfortunately, because of the very severe budget crisis in the California court system, all of those things are really suffering. And so, you know, it is a case, I think, that being able to access judicial opinions is not the number one thing on the agenda, but it is certainly just one in a number of problems that is resulting from the severe underfunding of the court system. I mean, you can look at there are courts without court reporters where, you know, litigants have to basically take their own record of what has just happened. And, you know, again, we're seeing just another example of why it is so problematic to have an underfunding of the court system.
Let's turn now to Bryce in Burlingame.
Hi. I think to start off with, it seems to me that we have a pretty good hybrid system that tries to mitigate most of the problems with each. But my question really is, what more could we do to introduce a more technocratic element? Things like a maximum rate of reversal to even qualify for a reappointment election.
Professor Gaylord?
I guess I'm not fully sure as to what the suggestion is in terms of having other requirements to make it to a retention election. I mean, obviously states have a lot of control over the structure and nature of the elections as to whether they want to have sort of caps on certain types of decisions or other things. If that was the suggestion, then I guess I'm concerned with trying to handcuff judges and put sort of artificial barriers as to the nature of the decisions and what they have to do in particular instances in terms of the ability to be independent. If you know you have certain guidelines that you have to meet in order to even make it to a retention election, and I'm not a big advocate of retention elections, given the fact, as I mentioned, that it's more like a de facto appointment and doesn't provide any meaningful check, in my view. But to have those types of requirements, I think, is risky in terms of the independence of the judiciary.
Bryce, thank you so much. Oh, Professor Levinson.
Sorry. So just two quick comments on that. One, you know, Bryce said the hybrid system works pretty well. I mean, I do want to mention that in California, elected judges are disciplined at much higher rates than appointed judges. So I'm not really at the point where I'm able to accept that. But if we do want to talk about maybe additional criteria, maybe we can look at discipline. I mean, maybe that should be one of the main things that we look at if we really are going to keep judges on the ballot, which sadly I think we are. You know, how often are there transgressions? How often are there disciplinary actions, and how often are those successful?
Well,
that type of information, I think, would be very important to have. That type of information where you have ethics violations or other things that go to character and may directly impact, the more that can be available, I would agree, would be important information.
When you do have a bad apple, though, it can take years to get that person off the bench, maybe even a federal indictment. Is there any evidence that bad apples on the California bench, Professor Levinson, are being taken off it?
Well, not everyone. So, you know, I will say, I mean, this is kind of, I just wrapped up the semester, and we spent a lot of time talking about, okay, this plaintiff is so sympathetic. Why can't they get redress? And because we don't create laws just based on this plaintiff should be able to recover, and we shouldn't create laws just based on we need to make sure this bad actor gets out. What we should do is create laws that work for, you know, the greatest number of us, whether it be litigants or whether it be judges. And, you know, certainly if I want to eliminate elections, which I do, will it mean that we keep some bad apples on the court? Yes. But I also think that elections mean we get some bad apples on the bench. So, you know, it's no perfect system. It's trying to make sure that the, I guess, the fruit is as fresh as possible.
Any last words, Professor Gaylord? And possibly a metaphor if you can throw one in.
I'm thinking about food. I think, you know, in general, these are really important questions and important to have these types of dialogues and for your listeners to really think carefully about what they want. Again, not just reacting to a particular opinion, but what can they do about the judiciary itself? And if there is the groundswell of support to move, that's to get involved and to get active and try to take steps to do that. The judiciary is supposed to be a co-equal branch, but it's so dramatically underfunded, it's really threatened in terms of what it can do, and we need to work collectively to improve that system to the benefit of all.
Professor Scott Gaylord, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the program.
Professor Jessica Levin, a pleasure as well.
Thank you very much.
This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Myra.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.